You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.
Of attracting the wrong type of guy, it was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
90 Day Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Day Solutions.
Welcome to 90 Day Soulmate with Jim
and Lisette. Today's backwards day.
Yeah.
Why? I don't know. So today we're going to talk about a couple of things. One is, I think rescuing is something, is that sometimes we get into a relationship and we think we can rescue the person. The other day on Facebook, I was telling Lisette, there was a guy who was seemingly to struggle with things. He was accusing people in his family about taking things from him and hiding them from him, and it seemed like really stressful. So I saw that post, and there were then responses from women I grew up with, like, oh, call me, chat with me, talk to me, let me see if I can help you. Reaching out to help.
Some kind of behavior for a human being.
And I think it's natural that we want to help somebody struggling.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is to know when that help is actually helpful versus an investment of your emotion, your time, your physical self that may end up in a trap. And while we're not saying don't help people, we're saying be careful of thinking that you can rescue somebody, one, who doesn't want to be rescued, or a response from another friend was, he's going through a very tough time right now. Talk to me before you talk to him so you actually understand the situation.
On the other hand is when the people confuse and believe his relationship with love is rescuing the person, you know. And this is where we want to have to watch out, because sometimes you feel it's falling in love versus I want to protect you.
And it's right that maybe part of that is, oh, I feel like I'm protecting you because you have challenges. So if I help you with those challenges, I'm being that protector. And
yeah.
And so what we want to do is we're going to talk about a story from our book. And it is going to be, let's see if the chapter is mentioned right here. Excuse me, as I will be sneezing in a moment, I'm sure.
You know the secret for sneezing?
Well, oh, you have
put
to go ahead.
Put your tongue in the top of your ceiling on the mouth, like that. No. Yeah.
So I can't sneeze if I'm... It may work, but I can't talk either. Oh, maybe that's the point.
Yeah.
Right, so my sinuses are acting up. It's chapter 8. It's called Russian Spy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story about Vincent's relationship with his second wife, Lily,
mm-hmm.
and part of the challenges that they go through. So Vincent and Lily have a relationship. They get married. They have a child. And this is right after the first child is born. Shortly after Rose's birth, the first child, Lily began to complain about her life. She was often tired and bored from being home all day long alone, and it was taking care of babies, not having really a lot of social interaction. And Vincent could appreciate that, though he wasn't quite sure what he could do about it. After all, he was the only one working, and the costs of adding a baby to the household were proving to be considerable. So, of course, both people in the relationship think they have valid reasons for acting the way they're acting, yeah. Right? One feeling that they're overwhelmed being at home with the child and bored, and the other one, well, I'm working, how can I help you? So, one night, Vincent arrived home from work to find Lily agitated. She was pacing back and forth restlessly with the baby and hands the baby to Vincent. Here, I'm going out, she told him, placing the baby in his arms. I'm going out. I want to have fun. I can't take it anymore. She couldn't take being at home anymore, she said, and she grabbed her purse and the car keys and left, not giving Vincent a choice.
I understand.
You understand? Sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Wait, you can't go like this. Let's talk. Vincent held the baby with one arm while he tried to stop Lily with the other arm. Lily stopped. She turned to Vincent and shook the car keys at him. I don't want to talk. I want to have fun. Her eyes were wild, a look that Vincent could not fathom. Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But what's wrong? Why are you doing this? He asked in confusion. I want to have fun. I want to have fun. I want to have fun, is all she could say. It's all he remembers, I think. I'm going out with my friends from church to a pool hall. I want to feel the life I had before I ended up in this house all day long, stuck in the middle of the country with you, with a baby, and nothing to do, and no one to talk to. I want to have some fun. Vincent stared at her in bewilderment as she practically ran to the garage. He heard the car's tires squeal in the driveway as she drove off to go have fun. Vincent tended the baby and put her to bed. He was worried. He had no idea where Lily might be or how to locate her. I guess this was early days of cell phones, or maybe even before cell phones. It was before cell phones. Uh-huh. So he had to send smoke signals from the backyard. When he heard the garage door open at 3 a.m, he breathed a sigh of relief. You know, at least she's home. It's now 3 a.m. He had no idea where she was all night. Leaving the bedroom, he found Lily lying on the sofa, half passed out. Vincent's sudden appearance startled her awake, and she began babbling, waving her arms when she saw him. Forgive me, I can't even do this justice, but forgive me, she said, dragging her syllables, her voice slurred. I'm sorry. Calm down and rest. We'll talk in the morning after you get some sleep, Vincent said. So she came home inebriated, mm-hmm. inebriated, drunk, too much to drink, not in control. Luckily, she got home. We'll talk in the morning. Get some sleep, Vincent said, trying to calm her. This was the first time he had ever seen her in such a state and wasn't quite sure how to feel about it, and even more so, how to react. No, you have to forgive me, she insisted, grabbing his wrist and pulling him to her. He patted her hand and eased away from her. All right, it's not important. You drank too much, but we'll work it out together, Vincent told her, assuming she was referring to having relapsed into drinking, which we have to talk about. So Vincent had met Lily from being introduced to her from a friend, and the friend's wife and Lily both had attended Alcoholics Anonymous together, and he was well aware of that. We'll talk about the rescuing a little bit later. She goes on, I don't know what I was thinking. I drank a lot, and I called my ex. She called her ex-boyfriend. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry I had to close that chapter. She had to just close the book on him. Vincent tried to understand what Lily was saying between stammers, but he felt his heart plummet even further as he learned about her activities of the evening. She had called her old boyfriend. Apparently it was important for her to resolve the unfinished business between them. You ever hear that? Like somebody gets into a fight or something happens and they call their ex just because it was a familiar relationship.
Every Friday? Oops, sorry. I need to close these things.
Oh, my gosh. 300 closers.
Yeah, it's a big wall. Yeah.
lot of doors. Lots of doors. With the support of her friends, Lily had called her ex's number, but his wife had answered. It had been an unpleasant scene, because when listening to a drunken woman on the other end of the phone, the wife didn't take the situation with a good attitude. "Forgive me, it won't happen again," Lily repeated to Vincent. He didn't sleep a wink in that short time until dawn. He got up, made breakfast, got ready to go to work. She got up, smiling, came into the kitchen with the baby in her arms, and greeted Vincent warmly. When he tried to talk to Lily about what happened, she seemed to remember nothing of the night before.
This is the moment that you have to stolen money, so she can remember. I do that.
Where did this money go? I don't know.
I don't know.
But that was a common theme of, well, when I say common, it would be a common theme that when there was a night of drinking, going out, too much to drink, the next day there would be no memory of the situation, the stress. And so Vincent was living this stress during the leaving to go to the pool hall with her friends when she came back and was drunk. And he was in the midst of all this emotional stress, which he remembered the next morning. But Lily?
Zero.
Zero. And I don't know how many people out there have relationships or friends or family members who go through that same thing with them. It's a very difficult thing.
Yeah, because how you can handle something that somebody don't remember.
Yeah, because to you, it's completely stressful. And then the next day, the other person's like, oh, it never happened.
Why are you stressed? Come on, be fun.
When I was much younger, I may have mentioned this to you, I had dated a woman, very nice woman. Her father would be at dinner with us. We'd go to have dinner periodically at her house, and he'd have a few drinks, and then he would just start being really nasty to the mother, to her, just derogatory and just mean. And it was, when you would see how they would react, like they would be like, oh, this is typical, and like, just don't say anything, just let it happen. And I didn't understand it, but then the next day he was the nicest guy. I'm like, I don't get this.
It's love.
It's love. But this was one, you know, different personalities under some sort of, you know, if it's alcohol or drugs or something, it's a personality that almost seemed like was not their personality.
Completely different, yeah.
Completely different. And then it puts the stress on the family. But going back to rescue. So early on, Vincent had realized that Lily had an addiction that she had seemed to keep under control.
And maybe Vincent believed, if I stay with her, I can keep this.
Keep and help.
In a good way, yeah.
So we have a little information on that. It's a very difficult, complex subject for people. If someone in your life is having that struggle, it really is difficult to say, do this or do that. There's so many different complications in how to help somebody or to help them understand that they actually need to be the one to decide they need help.
Yeah, because it's a combination between the family and the critical person, yeah.
It is, and there's got to be a point in life, and sometimes people are like, well, they got to get to a low enough point where they realize it's all you know, they got to hit bottom. You know, you've ever heard, hit rock bottom. And maybe you've never heard that expression.
No, what does that mean?
When you hit rock bottom, maybe you lose your job, you total your car, something happens in your life that ruins you financially, maybe at work, maybe you get injured, but it's so bad that you're like, oh my, I have to do something. And so sometimes people need to hit rock bottom before they change. But we've got a lot of statistics that we're going to talk about in certain types of addiction, whether it's drug, alcohol, other. We're going to focus on basically two, but it's kind of, there's some interesting things because in the research that we did, we came across some things that kind of was new information. And we're going to share that in a little bit when we come back on 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette
and Jim.
Be right back.
soon she went on a perfect date. And then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
90 Days Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Days Solutions.
Welcome back to 90 Days Soulmate with...
Lisette.
Oh, thank you for saying that. With Lizette.
And...
Jim.
Okay.
Let me try that again. Welcome back to 90 Days Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Oh my gosh. What happened was we got so involved during the break with our commercial sponsors, we completely forgot where we were for the moment. And then when we came in, I thought I jumped in too soon, so I rethought what I was saying, and then I forgot what I was saying. Anyway, so going back to addiction, recovery, and all that, there was a study that was done. It was a mega study, a mega meta, where they took data from many different studies and took a look at treatment people have for recovery. Depending on how you look at the data, it gives you different thoughts about what is alcoholism, what is addiction, what is drug addiction, and is it treatable? Is it not treatable? Because in my head, I thought, oh, it's chronic, like you, because of my experience with it within family, friends, and loved ones, and seeing how prevalent it's been the entire life of that person, I thought it's chronic. Once you are, quote, addicted, that you just can't, like, even if you recover in a short period of time, you tend to turn back towards the addiction. And when looking up the research, what kind of, I don't want to use the word shocked me, but was a surprise, was, yes, people do have to deal with it their entire lives, but there aren't, that the majority of people aren't relapsing and relapsing and relapsing.
So it's like the cycle, yeah.
So it's not a continuous cycle, although I bet you a lot of us have witnessed that. And so, for instance, this talks about alcohol, cannabis, opioids, stimulants, and other drugs, and talks about the number of recovery attempts. So they say the average number of recovery attempts for those in this study was something in the area, the average was like 5.7 times that they tried to go through recovery. But what happens is that the statistics are skewed. That most people only go one or two times through recovery. So there's something called a mean. The mean is average. Average is you should add up all the numbers of attempts. Like, say there are four participants in a study, and one only needed one attempt, and then they recovered, and they no longer went back to the drug or the alcohol or the cannabis, the marijuana or whatever, that was it. That one recovery was all it took. And then there were two. So let's say there were four total people in the study. And then there were two people that took two attempts. They went once, they recovered, they then tried it again for whatever reason and had to go back for recovery again. But after the second attempt, they no longer, for the rest of their life, or at least to the point that this, you know, 18, 20 years later, where the study kept following up, they stayed in the recovery. They did not go back.
Okay.
So you had one that only took one attempt, two that it took two, but then the fourth person who participated took 15 attempts.
Wow.
But why I'm showing it is that is the person who goes back and forth. But this is how statistics get skewed and how people can say, oh, they can make them say what they want to say. So though three people took one or two times to recover and it worked for them, one person went 15 times and probably is still going today, you know, over that 18-year period.
Yeah.
They took that many times. So the statistics are this. You add the one, you add the two and the two, and you add the 15, and you get 20, a number of 20 attempts. When you divide that by four people, the average is five attempts. You go, oh, the average attempts it takes to recovery is five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not.
It's not.
for three of the people, 75% of the people in this fictitious example took one or two times.
Yeah.
And that is what it is like in real life, that the majority of people, one or two attempts at recovery, then put them on a clearer path for the rest of their life. But there are people who go up to 100 times, you know, like multiple times a year, they're going to try to recover. And those, what they call outliers, those unusual cases, is what we typically see. We see those people in our lives. We see those people where we work, relatives, friends. Those are the people that we see over the lifetime, and that's sometimes why we skew our own thoughts of what addiction is.
Yeah. Go.
And for some people, they can, you know, one or two times, and they're like, okay, I'm back on the straight and narrow. So the charts that we have here, and this is the chart, this is the chart I'm talking about, and I'm not going to show it right now, but it shows this huge number of people that only at one or two attempts of recovery, they're fine. And then there's like a couple of numbers, 2, 3, 4, 5, but then all the way out near 100, there are a couple people. So there's a whole bunch near the one or two attempts, majority. And so in the statistics for these studies, it turned out the average was 5.7 attempts, but there's a word called the median. The median is what is the middle number, if you just put all the numbers together of how many attempts that, you know, participant one is one, participant two is one, participant three is one, participant four is two, participant five is 100. Well, the median in there, that middle number would be one. Yeah. And so the median is way down low, but the average is high. So this is where when people write up reports and they try to convince you of something,
they can manipulate the data.
But they're not manipulating the data. They misrepresent.
Yes, how you represent the data.
So it's the data.
Mm-hmm.
But they use the word, oh, the average is 5.7 times. So, you know, it takes a lot to recover. But really, generally speaking, recovery efforts by most people is relatively quick. And there's the data that goes behind that. So I went through that example. I grew up in the marijuana illegal, alcohol legal time frame, that, you know, marijuana and other drugs are illegal, and you see more and more marijuana being legalized, which at first, growing up with it being illegal, I'm thinking, oh, it's terrible, it's awful, you know, and then you start seeing studies where there are a lot of studies that are putting it out there as not being as bad as you think it is. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe it isn't. Let me start reading studies. Well, it turns out that there is something called marijuana addiction. Just like alcohol addiction, there's marijuana addiction. Some of the studies they did on this showed that, let's talk about alcohol versus marijuana, that alcohol, the amount that people drank alcohol versus the amount that was deadly, like if you were drinking alcohol, was something like a 10-to-1 ratio. Like if you drank this much and you started to feel a little drunk, if you drank 10 times more, you'd die. With marijuana, they looked at it that for what people smoked, that this much that they smoked to get them in whatever state they wanted to feel, it took 1,000 times more than that to be something that would kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the however point of this is, alcohol use, high alcohol use over a lifetime can create many, many medical problems. Turns out that marijuana can also, but in a different way, in different things, in different aspects. Marijuana addiction turns out to be 9% of people who try marijuana become addicted as adults. But 17% of children, the younger you are when you start smoking it, the higher likelihood you become addicted. and addicted, whether it's addicted to alcohol or addicted to marijuana, the consequences are the same. The consequences are you can't stop doing it, that it changes your brain. You were talking about the hippocampus. Remember the hippocampus?
Yeah.
Hippocampus.
No, hippocampus. No,
Camden, New Jersey. The hippocampus. You'll forget you're in Camden.
Go ahead. Sorry. That point.
So that has something to do with memory.
Yeah.
That the cannabis affects portions of your hippocampus that affect long-term memory. And has been shown that those who are addicted to marijuana, one of the things they do is they start forgetting things. That there are many consequences about being addicted to marijuana, just like addicted to alcohol. The problem is, and I want to bring up a problem like with work, that if somebody has an accident at work and we test them for opioids, drugs, marijuana, those things, if they come back positive for alcohol, then they're under the influence. If they come back positive for marijuana, well, marijuana can stay positive in your system for a long time. And now that it's legal, they could potentially not be under the influence. And so it's something that it's very difficult to put your finger on. But there are people who, you know, if you drink before you go to work, you're going to show up with alcohol. But if you don't drink before you work, you're not going to show up with alcohol. But if you had smoked any time in the last 48 hours, it shows up. It becomes this very difficult thing to work with. Again, people who believe that marijuana is not addictive, well, it is. Those who believe that marijuana is much more dangerous than alcohol, well, it's not, but it brings up a whole bunch of different challenges. And we talked about it, the doctor, the student doctor.
Yeah, now you're thinking that you believe it, the doctor go to surgery for do something, but he forget a lot because he's smoking marijuana. So I left my pencil inside body. I forget to take out.
No, what we're visiting a friend, and the friend's neighbor is a student who's studying to be a doctor, and we met him, and he was talking to us about how he likes living in the apartment where he's close to school and things. And he goes, the only problem I have is my neighbor smokes a lot of marijuana.
Every day.
The neighbor does, you know. So the balcony, 20 feet away, there's just this smoking marijuana. And he goes, I really have to be careful. I don't know if it will or not, but if I test positive for marijuana, I'm out of this program.
Yeah.
And we talked about it. It's like your neighbor 20 feet away drinking
alcohol
would have to come over and pour the bottle into your mouth for you to drink the alcohol. Anyway, so the other thing that's happened with marijuana, as these dispensaries have become legal, the amount of THC, the part of marijuana that creates the high or the effects in the body, back in 2008 was about 9%. It was increased in only 9 years to 17%. It's doubled. And now in the dispensaries where they did samples of the marijuana that's being provided there, the level of THC keeps getting higher. It's now on average 22% with a high of 45% in some of the products tested. That they're increasing the level in these products to have higher potency. Hmm. So whereas 9% to 17% of people can become addicted, just like with alcohol, you can have addiction.
Yeah.
It's now a legal product that is going to show up as a positive even if you haven't had it for 48 hours. It's just what I'm saying, it's a complicated thing. So I don't want to say it's good or bad. I'm saying it is as addictive as... I have memory loss. No, I'm kidding. It is as addictive as alcohol.
So what is this with the relationship?
The relationship. So sometimes we're in addictive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So our emotional being, our want for drama, our want for something that maybe we grew up with,
yeah,
is fulfilled or provided. That want is given to us in a relationship that may be unhealthy. So maybe we dealt with a parent who, you know, say you come from a household where a parent was alcoholic or had struggles, and so you cared for that parent, and now you find a boyfriend, girlfriend who you really like, that generally speaking, on most levels, you connect with, and then you see they have
a pattern,
and you say, you know what, I think I can help them. I want to help them. I love them more.
Because feel familiar feeling, because grew up in this environment.
Exactly. So I don't want to go more into statistics here, but, you know, we were talking about 12.5%. 1 in 8 people are addicted to alcohol. That's pretty close to the same number for marijuana. We know the effects of alcoholism, which is liver disease, high blood pressure, heart disease, stomach ulcers, lots of bad things. So there's bad things all around. And there it is. So where this all leads to is when someone chooses the substance, the use of the substance over family. And when you see a relationship like the Vincent Lily relationship, and there is the, you want to take care of somebody, but the person who, and maybe it's not really that much of a choice, it's a drive to do this. They know they shouldn't, and they do, and then the use of that product is a choice that's made that then takes precedence over the family because it disrupts the family. That is what we're talking about with addiction. So we're going to talk about what's the difference in a relationship about helping and enabling versus, you know, what is the difference between helping and enabling in a relationship where your partner or a friend or a family member is addicted, and how to maintain a healthy relationship as best as possible, and maybe avenues to get help when we get back here on 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette
and Jim.
Tired of attracting the wrong type of guy, it was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
90 Days Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Days Solutions.
Welcome back to 90 Days Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
We are talking about addiction. We're talking about, is there a way to see it early on in a relationship and then determine, does it make sense to invest the effort and time in trying to rescue somebody who, one, may not want to be rescued, two, may not be able to be rescued, and three, it may be simply a way of you doing something because it's your own kind of addiction. I'm addicted to helping people, right? So I need someone to be dependent on me.
And you feel love, and you believe this is love.
You believe it's love.
And you be attached with this kind of relationship.
So what's the difference? Like, say you are in a relationship and you find out that, oh my, I didn't realize this, but the person's addicted, even like a gambling addiction or something.
Coffee addiction.
Oops. That's an addiction?
Yes.
No, I'm a coffee connoisseur.
Okay.
35 times a day, I'm a coffee connoisseur.
Okay.
What's the difference between helping them and their challenge versus enabling them in their challenge? And sometimes words are very, like we were talking about before in statistics, mean versus median. I mean, these things are, you know, they're terms that we think almost seem the same, but they're not. Help versus enable. So helping would be I'm trying to help them solve, and it's easier to help someone solve when they want the challenge to be solved versus enable, meaning help them get away with their problem by not calling them out on it and also by like not wanting to confront them.
Ignore the problem.
Ignore.
So this is, you believe help, but maybe is able.
Enable. Sure, and here are some items, which is what are things that enable versus help. Mm-hmm. So you ignore the unacceptable behavior. Yeah, you know, like Vincent may have done when Lily said, "I'm just going to have one glass of wine," and you're like, "Oh well, you know what? She knows what she's doing. I'll just let her do it. I'm ignoring it," rather than, "Whoa, don't do that," because it led to the next and the next and the next. More stories in While Victoria Dreams, in what was it called? The Russian Spy chapter of the book, relating to results of alcoholism. Constantly putting aside your needs for theirs. Oh, they're too drunk to get to work, so I have to stay home with them and help them today because they're sick. Mm. Or, you know, what was another one? You told me the story about the person who drank too much during COVID and couldn't show up for meetings even though they were on Zoom. So they ended up getting fired, and now the wife of that person had to leave the home, take a job, go to work, putting their, taking care of the kids. They have to feed the kids. They have to pay for stuff. So now they put aside their own needs and needs of the family in order to make sure that person can stay at home and continue to drink. Or how does that impact the family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Assigning blame to others rather than the person with the addiction.
That is typical.
Oh, they had a really tough day at work. You know, forgive them.
Because I grew up in one tough family, so you need to be compassionate with me.
The drug dealer pressures him too much to buy those drugs.
Yeah.
She's so good looking. Oh, wait, is that how we met?
Yeah.
A love dealer. This was my love dealer.
Yeah, I traffic in love.
Traffic in love. Ignoring things the person does out of the fear of confrontation. And I would say that I'm probably that way. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to confront the person, you just want it to go away. So you ignore it, knowing that 3 hours from now they'll pass out, and by tomorrow they'll forget everything. So what does it really matter? And I think the problem with alcoholism and drug use is that when somebody is drunk or high or in process of this altered state, how do you confront them anyway? Especially when the next day they don't remember anything.
And also if the person don't have the tool or skill to handle the situation. Mm. And the person with the problem don't want to go to one specialized doctor or therapy or whatever, because believe I am okay, that is your problem.
And especially when they're in the midst of the problem, they don't think they have the problem. So I remember trying to logically talk with a very close person in my life when they were drinking, trying to say, come on, you got to stop. And you're having a conversation with somebody who's not really them. At least that's what it felt like, that you're trying to have the conversation with somebody who you think is your friend. And in that state, there's just no real logical connection. Although you grew up with the person, and you've known them for years, you're just like, I can't even have that confrontation. And then the next day when you have that confrontation, they don't remember anything that happened.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, what do you mean? What do you mean? Everything was fine. You punched a hole in the wall. I don't know. That wasn't me. The dog did it. We don't have a dog. Oh.
It's you.
It's me. I did it. Which speaks about that. Lying to cover up for their mistakes.
Of course.
You know, what happened to the front end of the car? Oh, the car was stolen. I heard that story from someone.
I just parking and somebody did because...
Somebody did it, yeah. And they got sick in the car, too. And I think they threw up 3 cases of beer in the car. How do you know that? I'm just assuming. It's just assuming.
Yeah.
And it was Bush beer. Oh. So here's some things that family and friends can do for support. And again, we're not recommending like specific courses of action. We're giving you general ideas, and you probably all know this too. One, educate yourself. Understand a little bit more about alcoholism and drug addiction. Not only the addiction part, but the consequences of. Because it's sometimes the consequences which is the rock bottom part, that may be a cause for a change in the person's action.
And also the normally people, I guess the first is important in order, because you believe, no, that is one time, second time, and third time. Yeah. And then you become like this is a habit, and you believe that you can live with that, but you be attaching with somebody that in one moment you are tired.
Yeah.
To risk or take care of person with a problem.
So should you stay in the relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question. That if it's, and this is why we want to raise red flags early in relationships. One is, if you're feeling an emotional commitment to something very early on, that is, and you see the person struggling and you go, I got to help them. Go, whoa, can you help them? And does it make sense to put that effort in where the end result may be, okay, maybe one or two times of trying to get recovery is going to work for many people, but if the person may fall into the chronic case and situation where 30, 40 years later, they're in the same situation every year, you know, things go better for 6 months and then a month they're off the wagon, you know, that you have to understand, is it a lifelong commitment or is it a few months and then, hey, everything's better?
Mm-hmm.
I know, it's a lifelong commitment for me.
Yeah, for me too.
Get support. So don't try to do it on your own. Don't do it on your own only research. You can learn stuff, research stuff, become more knowledgeable, but seek help from resources that help with whatever that substance abuse is, family support, therapy. Look outside yourself and outside your family and friends. Although family and friends can be supportive, it's good to get professional assistance, knowledgeable sources. Counseling, we talked about. Specialty help, people who specialize in things. Oh, expectations.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
Realistic expectation. If you do run into somebody or somebody in your family that has a challenge like this, is that the realistic expectation is that it may get better than it is, but it may never be perfect. That if you have this ideal expectation of, oh, they're going to go through recovery, everything's going to be great, they're going to love me even more now. Well, you can help somebody through recovery, and then you can find out that part of their issue is that they've got a little bit of depression, and part of that is because they're missing their ex-boyfriend. And that leads them to, and you start discovering that the expectation of, well, if I can help them through this, everything's going to be okay. Well, it's not, because there's a lot of other things going on in someone's life. And so the realistic expectation is, look at this thing holistically,
yeah,
not on a specific issue. Take care of yourself, most important thing. Don't lose yourself. Don't lose yourself in trying to help others.
Don't burn yourself. Try to be warm somebody. Yeah.
That's, I like that.
Yeah,
did you just make that up? Don't burn yourself trying to warm somebody.
Yeah.
That's good. Set yourself on fire to give them warmth. No, yeah. Don't do that.
Don't do that.
It's not good. Although, yeah, I won't even go into the news story about the earthquake in Turkey, but some people sacrificing themselves to save their children. And it's so heart-wrenching that what people will do. And those are some amazing, critical situations that, you know, we hope no one has to go through. But those are, we talked about putting someone under stress. What will they do when a situation arises and how will they react? Bringing out how they really are. And human nature for many people is wanting to help. And that's what's one of the struggles of this subject,
mm-hmm.
is that we really want to help people. And sometimes that expectation of, you have to expect that maybe it's not going to work. It might be that that doesn't tell you not to try, but you know, you may not be able to rescue everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And also we need to figure out that we know are a doctor or therapy to rescue your partner. So you have to be
exactly
clear who you are. Yeah.
The good news of all this is that if you are in that situation, that a majority of people were helped after only one or two interventions. They tended to be people who were happier in their life, because it turned out that those who had many, many interventions had a much lower well-being or sense of happiness in their life. The study showed that there was both a correlation between unhappiness and addiction and unhappiness in number of recovery attempts, that there seemed to be a linkage between depression and addiction and long-term addiction. So that, again, majority of people being helped after one or two recovery attempts, again, wanting to be helped and also having a more positive outlook on life and maybe wanting to see themselves recover.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, the contributing factor or result of, again, was depression, was feeling bad about yourself, having a low sense of well-being, contributing factor of the addiction, or was it a result of the addiction? And it can almost be a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel good, so I'm going to drink. I drank too much. I need to keep drinking. Now I don't feel good because I'm drinking so much. Medically, physically, mentally, I'm being impaired. If it's marijuana and I'm forgetting things, now I'm struggling more at work. They're calling me out on things. I'm more stressed, so I do more, it's a cycle that goes on and on.
How broke the cycle?
How to break the cycle? Well, for each individual who's involved themselves in the cycle, it sometimes is the most important thing is for that person to decide, I have to break the cycle. And another thing that was found in one of the studies is the longer the initial period of intervention, like if you go to a 30-day program or longer, the likelihood of recovery was much higher than shorter periods of programs. To have longer time of professional support, having people really looking after you, of keeping you away from the problem while working on success, that gave the highest likelihood of long-term success and recovery.
Okay, that's good to know.
So good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else that you want to bring up on this subject?
The person next to somebody like that, what has to do some kind of question to verify his addiction of risky person?
What you mean, if you're just meeting somebody or you're like,
no,
hey, are you okay?
Did somebody listen to the show and say, maybe I try to risk this person. Is one addiction or no?
Oh, we would. Yes. So is it an addiction to want to rescue somebody who has an addiction?
Yeah.
And maybe that's part of your upbringing and that you feel a need. And maybe that's a calling. That could be a calling. But part of that might be is to do it not personally as much of it as a try to do it more professionally. Help them, but don't fall in love with them while doing it. It's like you help them get on the straight and narrow and then decide, now do I want to fall in love? Rather than I'm in love with the art of rescuing.
Yeah. It's because it's the prince, you know, rescue the prince and the tower, you know. That's his own program that people believe.
Well, again, with the guy who was posting all the strange stuff on Facebook and having the women that I grew up with writing him, oh, talk to me, let me talk to you, like wanting to help him. And I'm like, no.
Maybe she want to have boyfriend.
Well, that's the challenge is that, oh, somebody's vulnerable, I want to help them. Yes, I understand that you want to help them, but be careful because sometimes the person isn't looking for help and maybe they are a little bit over the top and maybe they need professional help, not a friend.
Yeah.
And that's it. And we thank you for listening to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Hope you have a good week and keep up, what is it called? Keep up the good fight. And love one another.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tired of attracting the wrong type of guy, it was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. how she found her match? It is in the book.
You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.